Congregationalists cherish the right to think for themselves, and they extend that privilege to the pulpit. So in case you're a visitor, I should tell you that my philosophical and religious struggles may or may not, in the next few minutes, reflect the views of others in this church. With that demurrer, I begin. Very often, just as I finish my 2-mile bike ride to the West Branch YMCA for an hour of exercise, Dr. Steckley, please note, a large yellow bus pulls up beside the bike rack and begins emptying a load of children. They don't tumble out excitedly, laughing and talking like most kids. They're helped out, some in wheelchairs, with vacant stares and heads lolling on one side. And I can't help thinking what a strange mix we make. Those crippled kids, on a brief break from the charitable institutions where they spend their lives, and the rest of us. Whatever my thoughts may have been on the ride down, they're suddenly forced to ponder a religious problem which has vexed some of the brightest and best minds of several thousand years. My need to trace a brief history of that long struggle will make more sense if I share some other brief vignettes from personal experience. My wife and I once kept an adorable baby boy in our home for a year while his adopting mother, a dear friend, finished her year of teaching in a public school. After that year, we were around him almost constantly as he grew up to become a quiet, gentle young man. When he enrolled in a course I taught at the university, it was as if I were teaching one of my own sons. I remember how he called and asked to talk with me very late one night about girls and romance, and how I loved him for his shyness and sensitivity. Not long after that, while he was in the act of doing a good deed for his younger brother, he was suddenly, accidentally killed. There would be no marriage, no children, no life's work to help him feel good about his use in the world. You surely have to know that given my love for him, if I had had the power to keep that accident from happening, I would have done so in a minute. One day, as I walked out of that same building where I had taught him, I came up behind a girl in a wheelchair, waiting her turn to get outside. All around her, healthy, joyous kids were spilling through the doors, laughing and talking with all the wondrous energy of normal youth. Hopelessly wasted by a genetic disorder, she was simply trying to make the best of a life that would never be like theirs. And I remember thinking what I would give if I could undo the suffering inflicted on her through no fault of her own. A few weeks ago, when I spoke from my son's pulpit in Oklahoma City, the woman who made the announcements spoke from the floor rather than from the lectern where Kim Banta stood this morning, because she was in a wheelchair. She and I chatted briefly at the back of the sanctuary before we were to walk down the aisle together to begin the worship hour. Her face, was so lovely and composed, her mind so quick and keen, that I felt she would forgive my wondering what had happened. She explained that she had been handicapped ever since polio struck when she was only 18 months old. When my face showed how terrible that seemed, she gallantly downplayed 50 years as a paraplegic by saying, "Well, I've never known any other kind of life." Late one evening, not long ago, I was called to the hospital by a broken-hearted father whose wife had given birth that morning to the most beautiful newborn baby girl I have ever seen, including my own, only to have doctors tell her a few hours later that they had discovered an almost unbelievable genetic disorder. Convulsed with grief, I heard the mother say over and over, "I prayed every day that she would be healthy. Why did this happen? Why?" I'm one ordinary human being caught in a brief, flickering moment of existence. And yet in my lifetime, I've seen enough undeserved suffering to fill a book. So try to imagine the anguish millions of decent adults and innocent children have suffered over thousands of years in every country on earth. And I'm not content to leave that as a general observation, because generalizations have blunt ends. They don't easily penetrate our normal complacency. So let's think specifics, at least a few examples. We have some reason to dislike mosquitoes right now because of West Nile virus, but they help 2 million people die every year from malaria, many of them children. Now, I want you to add every other known viral or bacterial infection and try to comprehend how many innocent people have suffered and died over thousands of years from disease alone. Then add the countless millions who have died from natural disasters, like earthquakes, volcanoes, floods, and tornadoes. The documented numbers, and I have looked at them, are appalling. And they're only the ones we know from recorded history. Anyone who truly feels the enormity of human misery will be driven to ask, as the sermon title does, why? 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 I didn't choose that title lightly. Those words have gone up forever from hearts wondering why, if God is truly all-loving and had the power to create a less dangerous world, he did not do so. Two of those anguished whys come from the Bible itself. You heard one of them from the lectern a few minutes ago, because a nameless Hebrew poet began the 22nd Psalm this way, my God, why have you abandoned me?" Several hundred years later, another devout Jew, innocent of wrong, but dying a horrible death on a cross, echoed the same question. And before that, and after that, Millions of others who know the magnitude of innocent suffering have asked the same question I asked after each of those tragic stories I shared with you as we started. No one ever needs to feel guilty about wrestling with the problem of why bad things happen to good people, because the Bible itself records a history of others who asked and came up with differing answers. Let's do a quick survey. Much of Jewish scripture takes it for granted that suffering has to come from God, because there was no other agency to blame. If bad things happen to a city, the prophet Amos says, God did it. After the holy city of Jerusalem fell 150 years later, the prophet Jeremiah reminded his people that evil, as well as good, comes from the mouth of the Lord. And 50 years later still, the prophet Isaiah says, God is responsible for all things, including the bad things. And Job's wife explained his innocent suffering in the same way. God sent it. Well, you see, Orthodox faith in those days said, we all get exactly what we deserve in life. If Job, admittedly the most righteous man on earth, suffers unbelievable anguish, it's because he has secretly sinned and deserves it. The man who created the character named Job fiercely rejected that answer to the age-old problem, but it still hangs around. I know a woman who was told when her son was born with a genetic defect that it had to be because she had sinned. A philosophy that manages to excuse God for having created a genome where all sorts of tragic things can and do go tragically wrong. But a new explanation became available after the Jews spent two generations in exile in Persia, read Iraq, and encountered a religion that had two deities in conflict with one another, a good god named Ahura Mazda and a wicked god named Ahriman. In that religion, innocent suffering could be blamed on the bad god. So now the Jewish god named Yahweh could be absolved from causing good people to suffer, and a wicked deity named Satan could be blamed for it. Let me show you now how this change in thought is reflected in the Bible. We're told in 2 Samuel that God got mad at Israel. In the Old Testament especially, God gets mad often and does some pretty awful things. And when God was mad this time, he decided to use David to punish the people by telling David to take a census. I don't know what was really wrong with taking a census, but for some reason it was considered to be a bad thing. So, urged on by God, David does it. And then God promptly sends a plague to kill 70,000 people. Seems terribly unfair, right? But it reflects an early belief that when innocent people suffer, it has to come from God because there is no one else to blame. But after that exile in Persia, the man who wrote 1 Chronicles, I've just told you a story from 2 Samuel, 1 Chronicles just repeats that whole business. This man could not accept the earlier naive concept of God. So when he tells the story, he brings into it a dualistic concept like that of the Persians and blames Satan, not God, for urging David to do the census. Anybody ever tells you there's not a single contradiction in the Bible? Call me and I'll give you the chapter and verse. One writer blames God. Another writer in the same story blames Satan. Well, from then on, people did not have to blame God when the innocent suffered. They could blame the devil instead. So, have we answered the question? Well, not really. We've just pushed it back to another question. If God is all-powerful, why would God allow Satan to do such things? There's really no adequate answer for that, at least for me, but another way of exonerating God becomes popular. Okay, it's true, there is great injustice in life, and bad people do often prosper more than good people, but there will be an afterlife in which the bad people finally pay the price and good people are rewarded for their suffering. This idea, too, may have come from the Persian religion to which the exiled Jews were exposed, because it's almost certainly entirely absent from the Old Testament before that. No heaven, no hell, so that rewards and punishments have to be handed out in this life. You either get it here or you don't get it at all. But it became clear to people as time went by that bad people often live long, healthy lives, while good people often die young or live lives of great pain and suffering. Faith in life after death was one way of solving the problem of why this life can be so utterly unfair. Now you realize, of course, that the problem of innocent suffering exists only for those who believe in a God of perfect love, who can do anything he wishes to do. Since these believers, even with their limited love, would change the world if they could, some of them have decided that God is all-loving, but must not be all-powerful. In other words, a God of power is sacrificed in order to save a God of love. God is indeed perfect love, they would argue, and would save the innocent, but cannot. And more theologians than you might guess have gone this way to solve the eternal puzzle. In a related solution, some justify the way things are by saying, well, God wanted us to have free will. And when we exercise free will, we often have to suffer for it. That idea, by the way, surfaces in a current film called Bruce Almighty. But this doesn't work for others who respond, what about the millions of innocent babies who suffer and die, and for whom the issue of free will cannot even exist? And besides, if God is all powerful, he could have created people to be quite happy without free will. And if you say, no, that's impossible, then you've just denied that God is all-powerful. And I'm sure you've heard another solution. God allows millions to suffer so that those of us who see the suffering will learn to be more compassionate. It may be hard on the spina bifida or Down syndrome child or the one with Huntington's disease, but it's a way, they tell us, God has chosen to create more compassion in the rest of us. He might, of course, have created us to enter the world with adequate compassion, built into us, in the same way selfishness is built into the newborn child. And to say this is not possible is once again to limit God's power, logically. It isn't easy, is it? Which is why so many have wrestled with this problem over the centuries. You do understand, of course, that none of this, I must repeat it, is a problem for non-believers who can simply blame blind luck when a mosquito transmits malaria or a fly transmits typhoid fever or lightning, floods, earthquakes, and volcanoes kill millions of the innocent. It is only believers praying in behalf of those they love who must ask why. I'm in good company when I confess that I have found no final answer to this most insistent of all religious questions. So what do I do? You have a right to ask your minister what he does in view of these struggles. Well, I base my faith on the power of love as I've seen it in what seems to me its purest form. And I cite one famous example out of many others because it underscores a nightmare thousands of American soldiers faced, including myself, as they shipped across the Atlantic in World War II. Many of you will remember this story. One dark night, in an icy cold sea, an American transport ship was torpedoed and began to sink. There were not enough life belts. Four chaplains, I think that one was a Methodist, one was a Catholic, one was an Anglican, and one was a Jewish rabbi. Four chaplains, acting out their faith in the power of love, unfastened their own life belts and handed them to young soldiers. They then stood together with hands joined and went down with the ship. I have no questions to ask in the face of that kind of love. It goes beyond all logic. It convinces beyond all argument. And if I'm puzzled at times, as men and women much better than I am have been, by what it means to say that God is perfect love, this kind of love, I do understand. So, do I, despite my confusion over how the world is managed, do I still pray? Yes. And my best explanation for that will make sense from something Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel saw once during his captivity in Auschwitz. A place so hideously evil that he called it the kingdom of night. Listen. Inside the kingdom of night, I witnessed a strange trial. Three rabbis, all erudite and pious men, decided one winter evening to indict God for having allowed his children to be massacred. An awesome conclave, particularly in view of the fact that it was held in a concentration camp. But what happened next is to me even more awesome still. After the trial at which God had been found guilty, guilty as charged, one of the rabbis looked at the watch, which he had somehow managed to preserve in the kingdom of night, and said, "Ah, it is time for prayers." And with that, the three rabbis all bowed their heads and prayed. So it goes, and perhaps always will for some of us. In the dark night of the soul, terrified for ourselves or someone who means more to us than life itself, we will forget about logic and the unanswerable questions and cry out for help. Torn forever between reason and emotion, it's all we know to do. It's called faith.